Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How are digital media changing the world our teenagers are growing up in, and are those interactions also changing teenagers themselves? Most people under 25 have no memory of a time before cell phones and computers provided constant connectivity, and they're coming of age in an era when there are literally millions of apps available to help them do the things they want to do. But in studying how all that technology affects young people's well-being, my guest today has discovered there is an important difference between being enabled by apps and being dependent on them. Katie Davis is assistant professor at the University of Washington Information School. Her new book, written with cognition and education professor Howard Gardner, is called The App Generation: How Today's Youth Navigate Identity, Intimacy, and Imagination in a Digital World. Katie, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
So traditionally, we have defined generations essentially by when they were born. You suggest here that it might make more sense for us to start thinking of generations according to the technologies they've been born into.
Yes, that's right. So in addition to defining generations in terms of when they were born, traditionally, we've been defining generations according to common experiences, whether it's World War One or World War Two, the Vietnam War, different, 9/11, big experiences. What we were very curious and surprised by in our research was that the young people that we talked to define their generation not in terms of common experiences, but by common technology. And it does appear that that increasingly is becoming the salient marker of a generation.
And it does point out how very different things are. I mean, my parents are baby boomers and I'm a Gen Xer, but in some ways our childhoods had pretty similar technology. It's not the same for my kids and me.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And, it's interesting because in this book, Howard and I, we have a through line throughout the book, which is a conversation among three generations. And it's curious because the three generations are Howard, who is 70, me, who at the time of our conversation was 33 and now 34, and then my little sister, who, granted, she's my half-sister, but she is 17. And we found that Howard and I shared more common technological experiences than Molly and myself, even though we are sisters.
So who can be counted in what you call the app generation?
The app generation for us constitutes the young people who were part of our research, and we started this research several years ago, about 6 years ago now, and so really the app generation includes young people who are teenagers and emerging adults right now up until about 25. So they definitely were starting to come of age before apps were even part of our common lingo, but we really feel that the metaphor of the app and the particular characteristics and features of apps really define and exemplify the dominant mentality that we see in our research among today's young people.
And some of these young people view the entire world essentially as a collection of apps. What does that even mean?
Well, that's right. That's the case that we're putting forward is that in our conversations with young people and also with adults who have been working with young people over many, many years, we found that they really, when they approach certain decisions in their lives or certain interactions, relationships, they kind of look towards the relevant app to show them the way. So if they're trying to find the nearest coffee shop, they'll go to Yelp. If they want to communicate with a friend, they'll open up their instant messaging app. And, we all do this, but what we're finding among young people is each aspect of their lives is highly compartmentalized, and they're looking for quick, sure answers. And there's not really much room for ambiguity or tolerance for more open-ended questions and pondering.
So does this mean, we talk about this all the time, but are young people truly more comfortable communicating with or through their devices than they are communicating in the sort of offline world?
Well, so in our research with young people, and we talked to and interviewed and surveyed over 2,000 young people, so we have a lot of data, you know, they really do value the same qualities and relationships that we do. So trust and intimacy, those are really important qualities of relationships, but increasingly they feel more comfortable carrying out those relationships in a computer-mediated way. So oftentimes when we're talking to young people, they tell us that it feels a lot less risky to share their personal feelings through the screen rather than having to face someone face-to-face. And interesting, I've heard more than once teenagers tell me that they will often get into these very personal and emotional conversations in the evening with their friends when they're online, and then they'll go to school the next day, and neither one will acknowledge that conversation. And it's what I call fragmented friendships, where you have this very intense personal stuff going on online, but then it's just not even part of the offline world. Now, that doesn't apply to all young people, but it does come up over and over. It does suggest that there is definitely this merging to online forms of sharing your very personal thoughts, which is sort of concerning, I think, because part of building intimacy is showing your vulnerability. This is something that Sherry Turkle has talked about before us in her book Alone Together, which we certainly read and drew on a lot in our own book. But it's when it's much easier and less risky to communicate online, then that's what kids will do because it's just not as scary. But then what you're doing is you're bypassing that vulnerability and intimacy that is so crucial to true relationships.
That risk aversion is such a remarkable phenomenon for you to have uncovered here because it is not something we historically associate with adolescents. The aversion to risk, whether it's in relationships or anything else. I mean, yeah. We sort of think of them as kind of hard on their sleeves, and yet they have learned that there's kind of a bifurcated world, and there's one environment in which it's okay to sort of put it all out there, and there's another where you really have to watch yourself.
Well, that's true. And even within the online world is not a uniform space, of course. There are many different online environments, and some of them are more connected to your offline persona, and so young people are aware that they should not be taking many risks there. So, for instance, on Facebook and Google+, and increasingly on Twitter, depending on whether they use their real name or not. In those spaces, they're very deliberate about the self that they present, and it's almost brand-like. So, and we make a direct association again with the app. When you think about an app, often that visual external representation comes to your mind. If you think about the Wikipedia W or the Amazon shopping cart or the Twitter bird, apps are very much tied up in their external packaging. And we see that young people as well, they are spending a lot of time developing their personal brand online. At the same time, so that's sort of the risk aversion part. At the same time, there are still spaces online. There used to be more when not as many people were online and felt more anonymous. But there are still spaces that feel more anonymous. Because young people feel anonymous, they take risks. And often, unfortunately, those risks are sometimes, hate speech towards others. And places like Ask.fm is where you'll find a lot of cyberbullying happening. It's certainly not the case that young people are completely risk-averse in all aspects of their lives, but it does pop up in certain ways.
Well, and it's interesting that this is happening at a time when sort of a big job of their lives is the formation of identity, which is part of everybody's early life. But now there's the need to sort of find your identity, but also repackage it to make it sort of palatable to your audience, if we're talking about a brand here.
Absolutely. A brand is something that's very clear and decisive, and it's crystallized. And if young people are creating their own brand, that means that they're locking themselves into a fully formed, crystallized identity. But of course, a very important, both Howard and I are developmental psychologists, and so we know that an important part of adolescence is allowing the space to explore your identity, try on different identities, and really think about who it is you want to be. And part of that involves turning inward and reflecting on who you want to be and your values, what's important to you. So it is concerning that there's this sort of push for young people to decide right now on a crystallized identity, but also to have it very much oriented externally so that there's not as much time for that inward contemplation.
Is there any more flexibility? I mean, I know that Facebook is fast becoming something for, you know, old people to use, and teenagers are going to things like Ask FM and is it Kick? There are a bunch of different programs out there. Are they any more flexible? Do they allow for any more creativity than maybe the standardized properties of Facebook allow?
Yes, I do think that, and you know, it's starting to become, it's always been hard in this line of research to keep up with the latest site, and that just seems to be expanding exponentially. But, you know, as I learn about the new sites, they each one lends itself to different forms of self-expression. So how young people express themselves on Tumblr is different from on Twitter, is different from AskFM and Pinterest and Instagram. And I certainly think that there are different opportunities to express oneself in creative ways in each one. And actually, just this morning I was looking at my sister Molly's Twitter feed, and she's an aspiring actress at NYU right now at the Tisch School. And she, the way she uses Twitter is just, I think, really creative. And she's certainly trying on a particular identity, and I can see it evolving over time. Whereas on Facebook, she's much more, you know, this single crystallized person who kind of the identity she presents on Facebook is palatable to a broad range of audiences because she knows that she has her grandmother there and her mother, her sometimes teachers and friends from all different aspects, whereas Twitter, she feels a little bit more anonymous.
Of course, that does seem, it seems it would take a lot of time to come up with different versions of oneself to try to unify this all in your head and then have your Pinterest self, maybe you're the girl who decorates cakes and, you know, on Twitter, you're the person who posts headlines about certain things. It sounds like a lot of work.
It does. I think it sounds exhausting to me. And actually, personally, I find cultivating many different social media sites quite exhausting. So I myself try to limit the sites that I'm on. But absolutely, I think you're right. The amount of time that goes into cultivating different online personas and, you know, trying to, if you want to connect them and integrate them, again, that is a lot of effort that may not be spent turning inward and thinking about what one really cares about. And there is evidence that, you know, quiet, the brain really does need some quiet time, and it needs some downtime. And if we're always filling up those downtimes with checking our phone and checking all of our apps, you know, that's not good for our well-being.
Katie Davis is with us. She's assistant professor at the University of Washington Information School and co-author of The App Generation, How Today's Youth Navigate Identity, Intimacy, and Imagination in a Digital World. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Katie Davis. She is assistant professor at the University of Washington Information School and co-author, along with Howard Gardner, of The App Generation, How Today's Youth Navigate Identity, Intimacy, and Imagination in a Digital World. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Katie, in addition to creating their own identities for, consumption through these apps, of course, for adolescents, it's also important to be checking out what other people are doing so that you can sort of be up on what's going on. How do they talk about their experience of comparing the sort of real life version that they know of other people and then the version of themselves that they are creating online?
Well, yes, they have a lot to say about that. So, I think it's very amusing that when I ask them, because one of my dominant focuses in my own research is identity development and the connection and disconnection between online and offline identities. And so, I often will ask them to think about how their online identities are similar or different from their offline identities, and they're often. The teens I speak with often are pretty adamant to say, I'm exactly the same, it's very consistent. That's usually their first response, but then when we unpack it a bit, they'll acknowledge some differences. But if I ask them how their friends are similar and different, they'll say that their friends glam themselves up and, really kind of put on a performance. So it's interesting that they all say that about each other but not about themselves. But yes, it's very much them. They are very aware that they are performing for each other. And often, and there is other research backing this up, that looking at these glamorous views of your friends and pictures of them with their other friends having so much fun and getting a lot of likes on their profile pictures, the result is sometimes it makes teens themselves feel inadequate, that they don't measure up because they're not having as much fun as the friends depicted in the Facebook pictures. This is something we heard a lot of the times in our conversations with teens. And a recent study actually that has gotten quite a bit of press from a researcher at the University of Michigan showed actually a definite connection between people who spent more time on Facebook in a two-week period had a more negative state of mind at the end of that two-week period than people who had spent less time. And these are teenagers and college kids. And then people at the same time in that same two-week period who had had more direct offline social contact had a more positive state of mind than those who had had less direct offline social contact.
It's an interesting sort of cognitive dissonance that these young people can say, I know for a fact that my friends are making themselves look better than they normally look, making it look like they're having more fun. And at the same time, they're looking around and saying, everybody's having more fun than I'm having.
That's true. So they are aware that their friends are doing this. It is somewhat of a performance, but still, you see what you see online and it looks, my dad has always told me, that you shouldn't ever compare your insides to someone's outsides because there's always going to be a mismatch. Even though you know that what they're doing is putting on a performance still, it just doesn't measure up to how you're feeling inside.
Is there any evidence, Katie, that young people are doing things specifically so that they can get a good picture for Instagram or so that they can tweet that they were in a certain place that they might not have been inclined to do if they weren't branding themselves?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So, yeah, I see this just in, when I'm out in the world, and I also went during my research that young people, and I suspect some adults as well, but I think it's more the case that young people do this. They will actually have certain experiences and craft them in such a way that they are all about not the experience themselves, but the picture that they'll get out of the experience to post on Facebook. I've seen this a number of times.
So What effect does this have on the way these young people relate to one another when the phones are turned off for that 4 minutes a day that it happens?
So when they're relating to each other offline, I think there are two main things that I've noticed. One is that they're never disconnected. So when they are relating to each other offline, they're not often fully present because their phone is still pinging them. And so they are relating to each other in a sort of distracted way. And I was speaking with about 80 high school students earlier this summer and asking them about how their relationships are affected by digital media and how they might be different if they didn't have any of these media. And at first, it horrified them to think, how would they ever connect with their friends if they didn't have a cell phone to make plans? But then they thought, well, if once they were connected to their friends and with their friends, they would actually be allowed and they'd actually be able to really engage in a deeper way because they wouldn't be so distracted by what was going on with their other buzzing technology. So that's certainly one way. And the other one is just what I had mentioned before about this disconnect between the personal feelings shared online and not shared offline.
So let's talk about apps themselves. On the one hand, you can look at these, the ones that are for social media, you can look at them as creative tools. They allow you to take a photo and maybe manipulate that photo or put it through a filter. They allow you to write whatever you want. On the other hand, there are pretty clear parameters. Everybody's profile page looks fairly recognizable when compared to somebody else's. Can you talk a little bit about how the standardization of that setup affects creativity as a whole?
Sure. So, you know, it's funny because we feel as though our phones and the apps on our phones are highly individualized, highly personalized. But, of course, they're highly personalized in a way that is completely standardized because we haven't created these apps. The app developers have created the apps. And so although there are a wide variety and a great number of apps available for download, and they allow you to do some really cool things, at the same time, each individual app is highly constrained, and what you can do within each app is very much constrained by the design decisions of the app developer, him or herself. And so it's not you who's in complete control of what you're creating. It's within a very specific set of parameters. And so in our book, we refer to this idea that was first presented by a computer scientist and cultural critic, Jaron Lanier, of lock-in. So this idea that we're using these various software packages to create music, to create art, and we believe that, or to remix existing creations, and we believe and feel that they are our own creations, but of course they're not quite because we are highly constrained. And it's curious, I think, to note that the person whose name is probably most closely associated with apps and that whole app ecosystem is Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. But of course, he would never have been constrained by someone else's app. He would always strike out and create his own app, of course, because he was a highly creative individual. And so he kind of really exemplifies this tension between app enabling, using apps just as a starting point rather than an endpoint, and striking out on your own and transcending apps versus app dependence, which is really being very constrained and seeing the apps as an end in themselves and not venturing out beyond what they allow you to do.
In terms of creativity and the potential limitations, how are the limitations of apps any different from, say, a musician who plays the piano being really limited to expressing himself or herself musically using a piano?
Well, you know, that is true. You've chosen the piano as your particular instrument, but you don't have to limit yourself to a piano. You can add in a different instrument. You can bring in someone else to play alongside with you. And the piano itself is, the notes on a piano are more nuanced than, you know, the same piano keyboard that you might find on an app, available on an app.
One of the things you looked at, and this is really interesting, is you looked at visual art and writing samples taken from students. Was it like 20 years ago and today?
Yes. Yeah. And so we're pretty excited about this line of research because, to our knowledge, there isn't anything else out there quite like this. So we were able to get our hands on actual creative productions. Visual art created by young people over the last 20 years, and also fiction writing written by middle school students and high school students, again, over the last 20 years. And we did an extensive analysis to look at how elements of creativity have changed. This research is in direct conversation with a couple of years ago, there was some research done showing that scores on the Torrance Test of Creative Thinking have declined steadily over the last 20 years, and it got quite a bit of press showing that people are less creative today than they were 20 years ago. And our findings show that really it actually depends on the domain that you're looking at, because in our analysis of the visual art, we actually found evidence of increased creativity, greater imagination. So the pieces in the more recent set that we analyzed were less conventional and they were more complex, and these are markers of originality and creativity. Whereas with the creative writing that we looked at, we found that the more recent pieces were actually a little bit more mundane. They were less likely to exhibit fantasy elements and surrealist elements. They were generally, you know, this is just a layman's term, they were more out there in the earlier years than they were in the more recent years. So we found that there, at least in our data set, that there were evidence of greater imagination in visual art and less imagination exhibited in fiction writing.
So what do you think might account for those changes?
Well, you know, I think that when you look at the visual art, I think it's hard to deny that digital media have played an enormous role in that. So, and the internet in general, the internet has opened up young people to just so many different works of art and visual stimuli that they can see on a daily basis. You know, they don't have to go to the Louvre or the Tate; it's all at their fingertips. And so they have a lot more stimuli to act as prompts for their own imagination. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, digital tools themselves allow young people to get started a lot more easily. So the technology that young people have at their disposal today allows pretty much anyone to be an artist and to get started really easily. So the floor has really been lowered, which is something that scholars at MIT talk about this, Mitch Resnick in particular and Seymour Papert of MIT Media Lab. They talk about how these new media lower the floor to entry into creative pursuits. They also, because they allow you to go so much further than you could ever have gone before, they raise the ceiling as well. So in that respect, you can kind of see why it's not so surprising that the visual art has increased over the last 20 years. The decrease in the writing is a bit trickier. I think that if you think about the types of writing that young people are doing today online, a lot of it is very fleeting. It's very much about the everyday little things that are going on in their lives, and all within a 140 characters. It really does seem to be aligned with communicating the mundane aspects of one's life, just generally. And you know, that kind of is reflected in the stories that we see. They're, you know, they're, the word language, word choice and language used is a lot more casual. The stories themselves are much more mundane and pedestrian. And that is, I think you can see that in the way we communicate with each other online. But I think, you know, as educators, we would be remiss if we didn't also consider the effect that formal education has had on young people's creative writing. And in the last 20 years, of course, we have seen No Child Left Behind Act and really the push on standardized testing and teaching to the test. And that, of course, includes teaching that five-paragraph essay, which doesn't really allow for a lot of imagination. So we definitely have to account for those offline influences as well.
Yeah. It does seem, though, that if one feels that there are sufficient venues for self-expression in 140 characters or in a snapshot or two, you don't really have to sit down and think very long and hard about how to make yourself understood in a way that would require complex use of language.
Absolutely. And you know, and I'm not saying that you can't be highly creative within 140 characters. It's just a different kind of creativity, and it's not the same as an extended long-form piece of literary fiction. And that really does require a different way of thinking than a shorter haiku type of creative production.
Are these young people also, I mean, is it standard reason that they are engaged with reading less themselves these days, at least reading long-form content?
Well, that's tricky. You know, I think the dominant narrative out there is that young people are not reading as much. But, you know, young people, so when the Harry Potter series came out, which was not that long ago, I was a fourth grade teacher at the time, and my fourth graders, 9 and 10 years old, they devoured those books. And so I'm not so sure that young people are not reading as much. They may be reading differently, and they may, you know, Harry Potter may be an anomaly. They may be reading shorter pieces. And we as adults, I think, need to consider what we count as reading. And maybe when we're thinking about what they're reading, we're not counting, you know, the Tumblr feeds that they're reading and the Twitter updates and things like that. But I do suspect that the type of reading is quite different, and it's probably comes at shorter spurts.
Katie Davis is my guest. Her new book is called The App Generation. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Katie Davis, who is an assistant professor at the University of Washington Information School and co-author, along with Howard Gardner, of the book The App Generation: How Today's Youth Navigate Identity, Intimacy, and Imagination in a Digital World. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Katie, to the extent that you would recommend that young people sort of go rogue with their online tools and find creative ways to use apps and ways around the limitations presented by apps, how can they start to do this?
Well, so we have a number of ideas that we present in the book. And as a professor at an information school at the University of Washington, I see the students that I teach in the informatics program. And I'm really heartened because they have the computational skills to be able to create their own apps and strike out on their own and not be locked into someone else's apps. And I think this development and teaching of computational skills is really an important one, and because it means that young people can take the technology in their own hands and forge their own path. And this can begin at a very young age. It doesn't have to start in college. And in fact, I was recently made aware of a recent Kickstarter campaign for a board game called Robot Turtle that teaches very young children computational skills without actually using digital media. So it's kind of a way to leave behind the digital media, but also at the same time teach computational skills.
We have an email here from John who writes, 15 years ago, while working in a computer environment with 20 coworkers, we were introduced to an online instant messaging program. What quickly emerged was dual communication. What happened in the online conversation was not mentioned in personal communication. It was a unique understanding, the power of the unspoken, that only deepened our understanding of one another. What do you think about that?
You know, That anecdote definitely resonates with me as well. I definitely feel that when I'm communicating with my colleagues, we're communicating on two wavelengths, the face-to-face and then also offline. The worry and the concern that Howard and I have is that for young people, if they grow up developing their very close relationships in that way, where they're very much bifurcated and not integrated, I think that can be fine in certain aspects of your life, but in those really important relationships, if they remain so fragmented, that's when I think there is sort of a worry for the development of intimacy. But, you know, in the case of a workplace, I don't see that as particularly concerning.
When you suggest to young people that they need a certain amount of time every day to sort of unplug completely, to reflect, do they greet this with, are they skeptical? Are they sort of frightened of the idea? Do they worry that they will be bored? How do they respond?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because I always do ask them to imagine their lives without these technologies. And at first I do see, and it's hard to record this, but I do see on their faces an expression of terror and panic at first at the thought of it. But then as they kind of sit with that idea for a little bit, I can kind of start to see a sense of relief come on their faces, because then they imagine and start to think about, okay, well, that kind of frees me up a little bit. One thing that often surprises people when I talk to them about my research, they automatically tend to assume that digital natives, quote unquote, are just, you know, they are completely absorbed and completely in love and entranced with their technologies. But the kids that we speak with express a lot of ambivalence toward technology. They often will say that they feel that they are wasting time. That they're both spending a lot of time online, but they feel that it's not always quality time. And then when you ask them to consider what it would be like to unplug, that's when they're a little panicky, because it means that they would be disconnected from their friends and their parents. But at the same time, it would open them up a little bit more, give them a little bit more space to breathe and to think.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Jeffrey in Carrollton. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question about the differences between generations. I often read generational studies where they compare young people today to people in their 20s or middle age or older, and they make fun of a younger generation for being more risk-taking or older generations for being more conservative. But these are stages that everyone goes through. My question is, how is this app generation different, or is this just the current version of the me stage in their development?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's certainly hard, to disentangle. It's very actually challenging to disentangle what's happening developmentally, because kids, of course, are changing developmentally. But at the same time, the technology is changing very rapidly. And so you've got these cohorts growing up, you've got the technology growing up, and it's hard to disentangle those two. But one thing that the caller noted that I think is interesting, it kind of goes against what we found, is that often when you have the older generation looking at the younger generation, often they will say that generation takes more risks. But what we're finding in our research, people are telling us that this generation is actually more risk-averse, that they are scared to death about taking the wrong step, that they really feel that they need to be following a particular life course, that go to the right school, take the right courses, go to the right internships, get the right job. And anything that takes them off that track is considered risky and something that they don't want to do.
Well, when you do this research, Katie, I'm curious about what steps you take in order to find causation as opposed to just correlation between different phenomena. And you mentioned earlier, you know, the change in the creativity in writing, and you mentioned that, of course, there could be a relationship between that change and the way we have amended our teaching practices. Can you speak a little bit to the challenges of figuring out what's related and what just seems to be happening simultaneously?
Right. Well, this is the ultimate challenge of social science research, of course, is that, and especially when you're studying something like technology and technology adoption, you can't really, you know, unfortunately, when I was in middle school in the early 90s, I didn't know that I would become a researcher, so I didn't have the forethought to create a randomized control trial and track people for the last 20 years, but you know, so it's hard to do that sort of causal research in this area. But what you can do is draw on a lot of diverse research data sources, and that's what we've done in our book. And we have a very extensive methods appendix where we describe our many different studies trying to answer this question from a lot of different angles. And so through that triangulation, a clear picture starts to emerge. And it's not just drawing on our own research in the book, but we also draw on the research of other scholars, some of whom they may not have, you know, done the traditional randomized controlled trial across time, but they do smaller lab experiments that can be highly controlled and show causality. So the study that I mentioned earlier about looking at people's happiness associated with their Facebook use, that does sort of suggest causality in that it was a two-week period and there was a direct relationship. If you use Facebook more, you ended up being less happy.
Hmm. So is there reason to believe that apps will grow more sophisticated and be less constrictive regarding how we present ourselves to the world and how young people are able to sort of express themselves?
Well, I certainly hope so. And, you know, I think a lot of where apps go and where technology goes in general, whether it becomes more or less constrictive, I think that has a lot to do with the designers of technology themselves. And, of course, it's hard to know how your creation is ultimately going to be adopted, but I do think it's important for designers to think about the type of society that they want to design for and the values that they want to design for. And at the same time, I think it's up to the app generation themselves to, because they ultimately are going to be the ones creating the next technologies, and how do they want to design for the society that they want to be a part of.
It'll be interesting to see how they raise their own children.
It will be. It will be very interesting because, and we haven't talked a lot about the role of parents in all this, but, you know, a lot of the kids we talk to, they are very aware of how tied their parents are to technology. And, of course, parents are extremely powerful models for young people. And a lot of the kids we talk to are kind of exasperated sometimes when they're trying to talk to their parents and their parents are glued to their smartphone or their tablet or their laptop. So, you know, it may be, and I hope it would be great if this current generation decides that when they're with their kids, they are really going to unplug completely and devote their full attention to their children.
Well, we have an email here from Monique in University Park who wonders what kinds of restrictions and boundaries should parents establish for their adolescents' online activities in order to promote healthy identity development?
Well, I think the first step before you even start to talk about restrictions is the modeling piece that I just talked about. Modeling moderation in your technology use yourself, and also pro-social use of technology as well. And then from there, I think the restrictions and the monitoring, it really depends on the stage of development that the young child is in. So the restrictions that you place on an 8-year-old are going to be different from a 13 and an 18-year-old. But whatever they are, I think it really needs to start with from a place of trust between parents and their children and open communication. So these blanket rules that are enforced sometimes by parents without really getting a chance to understand where the kids are coming from and what the technology means to them, I think that's somewhat misguided. I think it really should start with open communication and from parents trying to learn from their kids about how they're using technology, why it is. And so then the parents can have a chance to then share their side, how they would want their children to be using technologies, what concerns them about certain online sites and things like that.
When you talk about modeling pro-social use of technology, what do you mean by that?
So this comes out of one of our research projects called the Good Play Project, and one of our colleagues, Carrie James at Harvard Project Zero, has just written a book about it, which will be coming out next year through MIT Press. And in that project, we were looking at the moral and ethical dimensions of what young people are doing online. And some of our research was taken up by a nonprofit education group called Common Sense Media, which provides wonderful resources for parents and teachers to help promote positive interactions, social interactions online, what they and we and many others call digital citizenship. So, you know, ways to interact in a kind way with other people and rather than bringing them down.
Do you have the sense that parents who want to stay connected to their children after, say, they leave home for college, do they have any choice but to use apps for at least some of that communication?
Well, yeah, I don't think they have much choice nowadays. And from research from Middlebury College, it sounds like that's okay with them because there's a researcher at Middlebury College who has found that in the sample of college kids she surveyed, on average, they're in communication with their parents over 13 times per week, which is just such a difference from 20 years ago. You know, when I went to college, I maybe spoke to my parents once or twice a week at the most, but really I was out on my own, whereas today's college kids are still tethered to their parents in a big way.
So maybe that's technology, maybe that's the way society has changed, and maybe it's a combination.
I certainly think that it's broader than technology, but it's certainly facilitated and encouraged by technology.
Katie Davis is assistant professor at the University of Washington Information School. Her new book, written with cognition and education professor Howard Gardner, is called The App Generation: How Today's Youth Navigate Identity, Intimacy, and Imagination in a Digital World. Katie, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find us on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.